We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour, we'll be talking with Richard McNally. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University. And we'll talk about some of the ideas that you'll find in his book, What is Mental Illness? It's published by Belknap, Harvard Press. A major health survey has found that almost half of all Americans have been mentally ill at some point in their lives. And I'm sure that when you hear that statistic, your reaction probably would be as my reaction was when I first read it, and that was to question it, to say, really, can that actually be true? Do we have an epidemic of mental illness in this country? Or, perhaps, does that tell us something about the way health professionals in particular think about mental illness? Have we become too eager to put the label of mental illness on the challenges of everyday life? That is one of the questions that we will take up this morning and that our guest Richard McNally deals with in his book. He says, indeed, that as we continue to broaden our understanding of the causes of mental illness, it is very difficult, remains difficult, to draw a very clear line between true psychiatric disorder and the kind of distress that people experience in their lives from time to time. So questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it's long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. And the email, you can do that too. That is WILL-talk, Will Talk, Will-talk at illinois.edu. And Professor McNally, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Let me start here with that statistic. I started with it because it's dramatic. You start with it in your book because it certainly is the kind of thing that will get people's attention. Where does that come from, that nearly half of all Americans have been mentally ill at some point in their lives?
That statistic comes from the National Comorbidity Survey, the revised version of it, a large survey that was conducted actually by my colleague Ron Kessel over at Harvard Medical School. It's probably the best survey out there we have concerning our contemporary definitions of mental illness and mental disorders, yielding about, as you pointed out, about half of Americans have been mentally ill at some point in their lives, and about a quarter of them have been so in the past year.
That's to me, seems kind of staggering, and again, it gets at this basic question that we'll be talking about, and that is the title of the book, is, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by mental illness? What happens if you look, just to make this more complicated, and I'm assuming that this pattern you will see in other places in the developed world. So if you go to Britain, to France, to Japan, places like that, you might likely see the same thing. What happens if you look at less developed countries?
Well, what is one of the surprising findings that came out of a related survey is when investigators, epidemiologists, translated the diagnostic interviews that were used in the NCSR and applied them to other countries, the rates of mental illness were substantially lower. There's multiple reasons for that, apparently. For example, in some countries, some respondents in the surveys may be less inclined to talk about such personal matters to a stranger who's interviewing them.
Well, that perhaps gets at a question, and that is, we try to answer this question, well, do we indeed have an epidemic of mental illness, or does this have something to do with how we think about it? If those rates are true, does that have something to do with increasing willingness of people to talk about psychological distress, to admit that it's going on, and perhaps also to seek out counseling?
I think there are several reasons to explain this high rate. If, for example, we step back and just ignored mental illness for the moment and talked about physical illness, imagine that you encountered a headline in today's New York Times that announces that 50% of all American adults have been sick at some point in their life. Yes, half of us have had the flu, a cold, cavities, and cancer and diabetes as well. None of us would be surprised. We'd be surprised at such a bizarre headline. So when we think about physical illness, we've all been physically ill at one point in time. When we think about mental illness, it's only half of us. That's one way of looking at it. A second factor is mental illness is a much broader category than the sort of iconic examples that come to everyone's mind when we think about mental illness. Most people think about schizophrenia, serious mental disorders involving psychosis, loss of contact with reality, and so forth. But people with schizophrenia only constitute maybe about 1% of the population, give or take a little bit. But mental disorders, mental illness, embraces a much larger group. Not only does it cover the serious mental disorders, the psychotic disorders, but also mood disorders, depression, anxiety disorders, substance abuse, and dependence. So when we think about mental disorders, it's a broader canopy than most people think, covering a lot more than just the severe mental disorders.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that again invites another question about what it is we consider to be mental illness. And in the book, one of the things that you deal with is some of the controversy surrounding the standard handbook that's used by psychiatrists and psychologists and people who are evaluating clients trying to determine what's going on with that person. And it lists a number of psychiatric diagnoses, hundreds of them, list symptoms. And so the idea is that that's supposed to be a tool to help one do diagnosis. However, that also I think the criticism is made is that over time, the number of potential diagnoses has expanded and that they include things that perhaps in the past we would not have considered to be mental illness. And there, in the past few years, a lot has been written about this, that to something like shyness, for example. There probably always have been people who have been uncomfortable in social situations if there are large groups of people that they don't know. And that's something either you deal with or you don't, and sometimes can be very challenging. Now we actually have a kind of a diagnosis that we can consider, and perhaps it's a matter of degree, but we can consider someone who is extremely shy to be to have a mental illness, and we may indeed have some treatment to offer them. And there is a central point here. There are people who say, you know, being shy is just some people are shy. Just like some people are anxious and some people tend to worry a lot and some people tend to kind of have low mood. Well, you know, that's just part of the human condition. When did that become mental illness?
Shyness, you mean?
Yeah, or any of those other things, yeah.
Well, originally in the DSM-3, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, third edition, the manual you're mentioning, the DSM-3 in 1980, social phobia appeared for the first time. Mm-hmm. As originally conceptualized, this was a very specific type of fear of certain social activities. So, for example, writing your name in public where your hand might shake and become visible to others, or speaking in public or eating in public, things of this sort. And what became apparent, however, is that many of the individuals, at least in clinical settings, who were seeking help for things of this sort, had much more broader concerns, social evaluation concerns, social interactional concerns that started to blend into what we might consider shyness. So it's not as if we're literally diagnosing shy people, but rather that our concept of social phobia has morphed into social anxiety disorder, which then abuts shyness. And where do we draw that line? Well, it's not as if we have some sort of a medical tests that we can do, as we can say for a bacterial infection versus a viral infection, and say, oh, this person's merely shy, not truly socially phobic. We don't have such a test. And so we wind up asking the question, to what extent does it impair that person's life? To what extent is the person concerned about it? And so this is one of the practical ways people go about trying to distinguish mere distress for mental disorder in the case of social anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Does this, I would imagine, though, that we could set up a situation where we could take an individual that either truly has mental illness or we coach them to show a certain number of symptoms, classic symptoms, and we have them interviewed by a number of psychologists, you know, say 5, 10, however, and then afterwards we ask the psychologist, give us your diagnosis. I'm confident that if we did that, we would get certainly more than one diagnosis, which maybe goes to the issue that sometimes doing diagnosis is as much art as it is science. But then that does leave open some question, I think, of the diagnosis if it's so unclear that we could have the same set of symptoms evaluated in very different ways by different people.
But that problem actually has greatly improved in the last 30 years. In fact, the original diagnostic manuals, the DSM-1 published in 1952 and the DSM-2 in 1968, provided only the most impressionistic, kind of quasi-subjective descriptions of depression, anxiety, neurosis, schizophrenia, and so forth. And when those diagnoses were so characterized by these sort of sketchy subjective descriptions, people really did disagree a great deal. So, for example, British psychiatrists viewing videotapes of American patients would often diagnose the patient as having manic depressive illness, whereas the Americans were concluding paranoid schizophrenia. Mm. And it was really those types of results showing unreliability, that is, disagreement between two different raters of the same patient, that prompted the diagnostic revolution embodied in DSM-3 in 1980 that compelled the field to be explicit about the signs and symptoms that warranted each diagnosis. And so the reliability of a lot of the diagnostic judgments have improved, at least in clinical research settings. And so people tend to disagree less than they did in the past. So things have really improved in that regard.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Richard McNally. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University. We're talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in his book, What is Mental Illness? And it is published by Belknap, Harvard Press. It's recently out. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. So this is how you think that this proliferation of diagnoses actually has been helpful in the sense that it may describe a lot of different diagnoses, but with concrete enough symptoms and defining them clear enough so that indeed the business of diagnosis is actually easier because it's much more specific. So maybe you have a lot more diagnostic categories, but the ability to with some confidence assign a particular diagnosis to a particular person has gotten better?
Yes, I think in many cases that's true. But there's a difference here between diagnostic reliability, whether two people can apply the same guidelines and arrive at the same diagnosis, and validity. Mm. That is, whether or not this diagnosis actually carves nature at its joints, whether it actually describes, captures a genuine phenomenon out there. So, for example, here in Massachusetts in the 17th century, you had very explicit diagnostic criteria, if you will, for diagnosing someone who was bewitched. And you could get very high reliabilities in Salem, Massachusetts, regarding whether someone was, in fact, afflicted by a witch. Now, no one today believes that the problems that the people in Salem that winter were exhibiting were caused by witchcraft, but the reliability was very good, the validity terrible. Mm. And so the question then is that even if we can diagnose certain conditions very accurately, is it in fact a real diagnosis in some deeper theoretical sense?
I guess I'm sort of confused by that. Are you talking about that reflects our inability to actually understand what's really going on at a deep level in the person?
Yes. Well, let me give you an example.
Yeah, okay.
You have the syndrome that appeared for the first time officially in the diagnostic manual, multiple personality disorder, MPD. It's been since redubbed dissociative identity disorder, but the idea is basically the same. And so you can have people who will exhibit all sorts of different behavior patterns. They'll use different names. They'll claim to have different personalities and so forth. And clinicians can, in fact, agree often if someone qualifies for that diagnosis. But the question is, what does that mean? One theory about MPD was that it resulted from a history of massive childhood physical and sexual abuse that resulted in the fracturing of the person's personality in such a way that each personality would harbor these dissociated or repressed memories of trauma. And the only way you could get at this was to hypnotize them and to bring the memories back, do recovered memory therapy, in effect. and then have them process the memories and then unite the personality, putting them all back together again. That was one theory. Another theory was that people who are highly distressed will be attuned to the cultural expressions current in the society at the time. And so, and that therapists themselves may inadvertently foster some of these expressions, that in fact MPD may be partly culturally constructed, so to speak. So you take some sort of basic distress and then it gets shaped by interviewing practices and cultural depictions of the disorder. But that once the cultural niche changes, the disorder vanishes. And so here you have a situation that the notion that this diagnosis that you can have reliable judgments about, its causes is quite different from the prevailing theory. That is to say, it's a notion that it's sort of a post-traumatic stress disorder involving repressed or dissociated memories of trauma is probably incorrect, hence invalid, even though it can be diagnosed reliably. Just like the witchcraft theory could be invalid, even though you could diagnose bewitched people reliably. Mm. That's the distinction I'm trying to get at. Mm.
No, there. Just in the first few pages of the book, there are a lot of interesting things that we could have a conversation about. I guess something else that this going in a slightly different direction, but I think it's also really striking is the idea that for people who actually are going to counseling, and you look at what it is that brings them there. In fact, a fairly significant number of these people, their issues seem to be actually quite mild enough so that they wouldn't actually be diagnosed as having a psychiatric disorder. And, you know, so one wonders, particularly if people have real serious problems, what it is that's preventing them from getting help, and is that a matter of stigma or is it a matter of access?
It's probably several factors playing a role in here. Sometimes it's a matter of access. For example, one issue that we have in our country is how can we deliver evidence-based, say, for example, cognitive behavior therapy to people with anxiety disorders who live in rural areas of the United States where trained specialists are simply unavailable. And so people who might be interviewed in those communities or in these rural areas may be suffering in silence but have no one there who can provide the proper treatments for them. That's one issue. Of course, there are some people that occasionally believe that they really do not have a mental disorder. They lack insight into the problems and therefore don't seek help. And so you have a number of different factors that will lead to the issue of unmet need, where people are clearly seen as suffering, but somehow they're not getting the help they need. Some of them do not have insurance. Some of them cannot afford it. So they have those kinds of issues. Occasionally they'll have substance abuse problems that will complicate matters. And the depression goes untreated. So the whole series of factors that can produce the unmet need problem. The other problem that you mentioned, if it's really truly a problem, was the surprising finding that many of the people who did seek help in these surveys actually didn't qualify for a mental disorder, leading one epidemiologist, William Narrow, to quip that we also have cases of met on need as well as unmet need. But at the same time, you can have people who can profit and benefit from counseling who do not themselves have a mental disorder. So, for example, people may seek couples counseling, whereas neither member of the couple has a mental disorder, but it's a relationship issue that could actually benefit from counseling. You can also have people, for example, who have had a mental disorder, say bipolar disorder, that has gone into remission, say, with medication, and they may be seeking counseling to help them sort of manage their life in such a way to prevent a relapse of the disorder. So you have some people are like that. So I really don't want to say it's met on need because not all needs fall under the rubric of a mental disorder per se, although the most serious ones do.
Well, just going back, I realize we're kind of jumping around here, but just going back to this basic question about the incidence of mental illness, do you think that there's reason to believe that, in fact, if we look at depression and anxiety disorder and bipolar disease and, you know, all these various kinds of things, and particularly the things that we hear so much about, whether the incidence of these things is in fact going up. That is, is there more depression now than there was 50 years ago? And are there more of these other conditions than there were 50 years ago or 100 years ago? You know, pick whatever time frame you want.
It seems to depend on the disorder. So, for example, the rate of schizophrenia seems to have been pretty stable throughout the 20th century in our country, whereas each successive generation throughout the 20th century seems to be afflicted by depression more than the previous ones. Now, why that might be the case is not entirely unclear. It's possible that some people who are members of older cohorts, when asked about their life, simply have forgotten that they once qualified for depression. That's possible. Some people who were depressed in older cohorts may have passed away and are not available for interview today. Some people in the past may be of older cohorts or may be less likely to say that, yes, I've had these problems because of the stigma issue. But then again, there may be factors of modern life, the sort of social mobility, the disconnection in social networks that have made people, especially perhaps psychobiologically vulnerable people in some way, more prone to those kinds of stressors and therefore more likely to develop depression. So there probably is an uptick in the actual occurrence of depression. Other conditions are perhaps even more dramatically the case, such as bulimia nervosa. People who binge on food and make themselves vomit and things of this sort. This is a relatively recent condition, and it seems to have increased in recent decades.
Well, this I think points to something, an interesting and also, I'm sure, difficult question about the causes of mental illness. And that is, to what extent is a mental illness the product of something that's going on in the brain, brain chemistry, and that it's likely that it's always existed to some degree because the human brain is the human brain, and that's just, you know, been the way it's been. And to what extent is there does culture play a role in this, so that you may say that you have a person who has a predisposition to certain sorts of things, and that then those behaviors will manifest, they probably will manifest, given certain kind of conditions. And, for example, if you're talking about eating disorders, you know, maybe you have someone that has some kind of predisposition to eating disorders, but if society wasn't so consumed with shape, particularly for women, that would never actually come out. You know, so how do you disentangle all of that?
Yeah, well, it's certainly difficult to do empirically. Conceptually, you might say that really the issue behind, say, bulimia nervosa are difficulties regulating emotion, issues with senses of the self, etc., and that people with those kinds of vulnerabilities in a society that emphasizes size and shape and bodily perfection to such a degree will be especially vulnerable to eating disorders. In a society where that's not the case, that might those people would not show that kind of problem, although they might show others potentially. In other words, the disposition may manifest itself in multiple ways rather than being entirely dormant. So, for example, in Niger, a formerly semi-nomadic society in Africa, the emphasis is on girls being as chubby as possible. And so they force-feed the girls and try to make them as heavy as possible because heavy women are an indication of an affluent family. And so the pressure is completely the opposite. So you don't see bulimia nervosa in that society at all. But there may very well be individuals who have the sort of emotional regulation difficulties and so forth that might manifest in other ways, but it certainly won't manifest in bulimia nervosa. Likewise, in societies where there's not enough food available, people don't have the opportunity to binge. And so, once again, people with a predisposition wouldn't show that disorder, the bulimia nervosa, in those conditions.
Well, is there, if you look at some, some of the most basic mood disorders, think about something like depression, or perhaps also, phobias, anxiety, things like that. Is there reason to believe, as long as modern humans exist, that these things have existed and people have experienced them? Because if we could go back and do some therapy with, we could pick up a bunch of Cro-Magnon people and do therapy on them and ask them, you know, we could do this, conduct this experiment, that we would also find that there were people there who had serious depression and had bipolar disease and, you know, all of the things that we see in people now?
Well, the best data addressing that question really doesn't take it quite as far back as you are taking it. So, for example, thanks to internet search engines and the like, historical scholars have asked the question, can we identify some of the disorders that we'd immediately recognize as being in our DSM today in antiquity? And again, we get a little bit of a mixed picture. So if we look at Greek and Roman antiquity, you find some of these conditions being immediately apparent. Depression, certainly, manic depressive illness, alcoholism, epilepsy, even social phobia, you can find that. But the mysterious one that seems to be missing in these earlier accounts, schizophrenia. We don't find descriptions of classic schizophrenia appearing in either the medical literature or in the literary literature, plays, poems, etc., in really until roughly the 17th, 18th century, which raises the question, as some historians and scholars have suggested, that perhaps there's some sort of an infectious disease or some various genetic mutations, etc., that gave rise to schizophrenia relatively late in the history of human beings, in the same sense that, say, AIDS arrived on the scene relatively late. So I think it's probably a bit of a mixed picture. Whether or not some of these conditions that are identifiable in antiquity would be also identifiable in prehistory is a tougher question. And people have occasionally examined hunter-gatherer societies that exist today in an attempt to answer that kind of a question. And the results are a little bit mixed. So, for example, there was one report of hunter-gatherer societies in Africa showing some of the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder in people who'd been victims of domestic battering. But it's difficult to test the Cro-Magnon question directly. So people have tried to do that with hunter-gatherer societies today, of which there are very few left.
Well, maybe I was trying to draw. I guess I was trying to draw the example as extreme as I could. But it maybe is enough to say, as far as we have written records of people talking about what life was like, that we can at least see some things that we would recognize as mental illness that we have names for today, and that we have diagnoses for, and maybe we have some treatment for. So from that perspective, you could have some basis for making the argument that this may indeed be part of the human condition and may well have been with us for a very long time, if not to the place where the earliest human being started to walk around.
Right, that's true. I mean, another example of this would be anorexia nervosa, which does seem to have a much longer history than bulimia nervosa does. In fact, some historians have identified it in certain saints of the Middle Ages who were starving themselves. Holy anorexia, someone's book was entitled. And this sort of a syndrome was very, very similar to what we have today, except for the motivation seemed to be a little bit different. These saints were not worried about appearing too fat and too chubby and things of that sort. They didn't have a fear of fat, but they had all the other behavioral attributes of a patient today with anorexia nervosa. And so is it the same thing? Yes, if you have a little asterisk next to that and say that, well, as long as the person isn't motivated purely by a fear of fat, you do see it throughout history.
Our guest this morning is Richard McNally. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University. We're talking about some of the ideas you will find in his book, What is Mental Illness? We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Lunch is also served on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30 and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're here with different topics for you every day. In the second hour today, we'll talk about what is a growing field in medicine when it comes to pain treatment. And the terminology may be unfamiliar to you, but it's something that's called interventional pain management. And basically what it involves is not just treating symptoms of pain, but trying to figure out what is going on and then getting at the causes. And we'll be talking with Dr. Hyun-Chul Jung. He is a physician and indeed is head of the Department of Interventional Pain at Carl Hospital. So we'll talk about that in the second hour today. Tomorrow morning in our 10 o'clock hour, our guests will be Mark Leonard and Jay Pierce. Mark is our general manager for Illinois Public Media. Jay is our director of created content. Every once in a while, they are on this program to give you a direct opportunity to make comments on the programs that you hear on the station. So if you have something you'd like to say you like or you don't, whatever, you can do that tomorrow in our 10 o'clock hour. And we are here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can check out the schedule or listen to past programs by going to the website will.illinois.edu. We also would like to remind you that there is a flash flood warning in effect for Macon, northern Moultrie, and southern Piatt counties in our severe weather coverage area that will be in effect until 11:30 this morning. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Richard McNally. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University. He is author of the book, What is Mental Illness? It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And questions are welcome. We have a couple. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll talk with some people here starting with Champagne and line number one right here. Hello. Yes.
There's been a lot of evidence linking stress, you know, increasing amounts of stress, maybe even in terms of depression. So, what's your feeling about this particular aspect? And I'll just go off here.
Okay.
Yeah, the caller is absolutely correct. It's almost always find stressful life events preceding the onset of depression, or at least the first episode of depression among people who have depression. Almost always that's the case. It seldom appears out of the blue completely. Now, what's interesting, however, though, a little bit of a mystery, is that people who have recovered from that first episode and then have had other episodes in their life following that, the connection between an immediate stressor and the subsequent episodes seems to be somewhat decoupled, whereas you'll find people who have the stressors don't get depressed, and people get depressed without any obvious stressor. Why that's the case is not entirely clear, but certainly with the initial episodes of depression in someone who develops this problem, you definitely find these major stressors.
All right. Hope that gets at the question. Let's go on to someone here in Effingham. This is line four. Our toll-free line. Hello.
First, your guest, his name reminds me of some of my ancestors who had shortened, I think they were from Ireland, from McNally just to Nally. Are your ancestors from Ireland?
Yes, they are. The McNallys are from Waterford, and on my mom's side, they're from Galway and Cork.
Well, during the psychological input to the No Irish Need Apply, when the economy was, evolving. My real question is, have you or read or familiar with Wilhelm Reich?
Yes. He was a rather unusual psychiatrist of the 20th century who had some very unusual ideas about this energy orgone that he postulated, and had these boxes that would sort of collect this sort of cosmic energy to help people and so forth, which did not have a lot of good evidential support behind it, to say the least.
Temple Grandin, every time I mention Dr. Reich's name, then this is the peak of what is thought of about him. But Temple Grandin, who was a U of I graduate with a doctoral degree, and she had an ailment that just escapes me just now, where she could not articulate real well, but her ideas were fantastic. And her father had invented a hug box for her, and it worked for her. Well, if Reich died in prison because of patent rights, and I am assuming there was some connection between those two, but he was more than a hug box. I have not read his stuff because I'm a layperson, and I have to go slowly to understand. But I've gotten through one of his first books called Sex Doll, and now the second is Character Analysis, and another shorter one that speaks of sexual repression. And that being the case, and how we are socially organized now, and I'm thinking that the erotica of Western life, and as that is passed on to wherever we can get our colonialist ideals planted, and then gives rise to the very subject that is being talked about this morning, and the psychiatric damage that erotica, in my opinion, does manipulates one's whole life. And now we have radio, TV, magazines, and a whole plethora of sources that can intervene, and then the discombobulation that accrues from that, and then I think plays into the very subject matter this morning. Thanks. I'm sorry I went on. Bye.
Well, I don't know if you have some way of reacting to that. I must confess I'm not exactly clear on the point the caller was trying to make.
Well, just to comment on the other issue you mentioned about Dr. Grandin and the hug box and so forth, I don't know the details of what Dr. Grandin's father was doing to help her in this regard, but I would imagine he surely was not making sort of exotic claims for such boxes capturing the universe's energy and providing healing and so on and so forth that Reich was making, and it got him into the trouble that the caller mentioned. But otherwise, I really have no other really real comment on what he said.
Well, let me ask you something very different, and this is something that you also deal with in the book that I think is quite an interesting question, and it has to do maybe again it goes back to my thinking about how it is that over time these kinds of things have manifest in human beings. If you look at let's say extreme mental illness, it's can be and usually is a highly debilitating condition. In fact, it can be life-threatening, as we know. Mm-hmm. And given that, one might wonder how it is that mental illness as a result of usual evolutionary processes didn't just disappear at some point. I mean, why do we still, if it's that maladaptive, why is it that it just didn't vanish because people who were severely mentally ill didn't survive? And if there was some sort of, particularly if there was some sort of genetic link to mental illness, then they wouldn't have had children, and eventually those genes would pass out of the gene pool and we just wouldn't see it anymore.
Right. This has been what has been called the evolutionary paradox of mental disorders. The paradox occurs because it's obvious from a lot of research that genes certainly influence the predisposition to various mental disorders. And yet, if that were the case, why hasn't natural selection eliminated those susceptibility genes, alleles, from the gene pool? In fact, mental illnesses are very common relative to other genetic conditions, which are extraordinarily rare by factors of tens or a hundred sometimes. So what's going on? Several people have speculated that perhaps mental disorders actually have had some benefits. They've actually conferred fitness benefits upon people with the mental disorder or possibly their relatives who share genes that that are also carried by those with the disorder, perhaps in a less pronounced way. But those theories have not held up so well. And what appears to be going on here is that you have many different genes contributing to susceptibility to mental disorders. And natural selection may very well be winnowing through that gene pool, eliminating others, but then you have other mutations that occur. So you have a bit of an arms race going on between the mutational load, between the new occurrence, the emergence of aberrant alleles and so forth, in the gene pool and natural selection. And so there's sort of a race going on, and the mutational load, if you will, is winning. So it's ahead. So you're not eliminating these things very readily. And so a few decades ago, people thought, well, maybe there's one gene or a couple of genes that may be the ultimate source of, say, schizophrenia. But this doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to have there may be some rare genes of a very large effect on the phenotype of schizophrenia in combination with many other very common genes that each contribute a little more vulnerability to the condition. And when you have such a genetic mix, it evades, so to speak, the power of natural selection, or it stays ahead of it, if you will. And so then you have the situation of something that is genetically influenced and yet still very common.
Mm. Well, we have some other callers here. We just have about 10 minutes left. And again, our guest in this hour of focus is Richard McNally. He is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. And we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, What is Mental Illness? It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And we have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of focus. We have some other callers here. We'll talk with them, starting with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello, line one.
Yes.
Yes. I would like for the professor to discuss, first of all, whether or not he thinks that suicide is a result of mental illness, and then why or why not he thinks there is a connection there. And I'm just going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
One of the facts that is surprising to most people in the United States with regard to suicide is that Americans are far more likely to die by suicide than by homicide. When you see television shows with people shooting at one another and murder mysteries and so on and so forth, you might think that the greatest threat to oneself by violence would be someone else, but it's actually oneself. Suicide is more common than homicide. You're more likely to die by suicide than homicide. But even given that fact, certain mental disorders, bipolar disorder, serious major depression, schizophrenia, are all associated with a significantly elevated risk of suicide. And how does that seem to work? Well, people who become very hopeless, who become disconnected to others, believe that they're a burden on others. Some theorists in this field, such as Thomas Joyner, have emphasized these points of some of the proximal, immediate causes of someone attempting their life. My colleague Matthew Nock has pointed out that in his research that when someone who is feeling hopeless, is feeling disconnected from others, and then develops sort of a state of agitation, sort of a roiling anxiety and extreme distress that goes with it, then that converts somebody from merely thinking about suicide actually to attempting it. And so when a person sees the future as being closed off and is experiencing this tremendous agitation and distress and hopelessness, that's when they're the greatest risk. And it's also made bad by the fact that they get kind of a tunnel vision. They see this as their only escape from interminable suffering. So suicide becomes a permanent solution to a temporary problem, because most of these mental disorders can be at least alleviated. And so that's the tragedy of suicide, is that the person believes that there's no way out. And through their eyes at the moment, that seems to be the way it is, even though that's not actually the reality of the situation.
So for it sounds like what you're saying is, at least for in many, many cases, what we're talking about here, suicide is not a mental illness, but what suicide or thinking about suicide, those kind of thoughts, that's a symptom. And it could be a symptom of a number of mental illnesses.
Right. There's a cluster of them in particular that are associated with suicidal ideation, thinking about suicide, and then planning, having a plan, and then, of course, actually attempting suicide. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who do die by suicide have been suffering from a mental disorder, and it's often one of those. Schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, bipolar disorder, serious depression, alcoholism, those are carry a lot of the burden, so to speak.
Right. To another caller here, line two in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. Previous caller referred to Temple. I can't remember her last
name. Temple Grandin.
Grandin. My understanding, as a result of reading Oliver Sacks' book, An Anthropologist on Mars, that she graduated from the University of Illinois as a large animal veterinarian and now works at Colorado State University.
Well, she is a graduate of the university. I don't think that she's a graduate of the vet school, but she has someone who has Asperger's syndrome,
right.
Which is a particular variety of autism. And for that reason, it seems that she's been particularly well known for understanding the experiences of animals and has done a lot of work in designing facilities for handling animals. And that's something that she's been particularly known for. And a lot has been written about her. She's written about herself and her life. And she's a fascinating individual. She's actually been interviewed on our air. I think if one goes to the archives of the Afternoon Magazine, my colleague Celeste Quinn has talked with her at least once. You'd actually have an opportunity to hear her talking about herself and her experiences.
Is your guest familiar with Oliver Sacks?
I don't know him personally. I've read some of his works. He's a neurologist.
Mm-hmm. Right. His book, An Anthropologist on Mars, and the second one, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat Rack, are fascinating examinations of the range that you find in autism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
That's true. The autism is one of the conditions that has expanded quite a bit. And here we have a case, I think, where our original concept of autism was really only that of the most severely affected individuals. My own clinical work with people with autistic disorder in the 1980s involved people who had no language, for example. They didn't speak. They had severe mental retardation and the like. Now we have this autism spectrum condition whereby the range of people that fall under that rubric is much, much broader. And so we have estimates of autism going up. They're not caused by vaccines. That turned out to be a totally false lead. The notion that vaccines are causing autism to rise in the population, that's not true. But our definition of autism has broadened. So Asperger's syndrome, for example, sort of falls under this general canopy of autism spectrum conditions.
Well, you know, we're coming down to the point here where we are almost out of time. We have a minute or so left. And there's much more that we could do. I guess raised the name of Oliver Sacks, it leaves me thinking this way, that, you know, with so many physical illnesses, we've made great strides in diagnosis. We have all kinds of diagnostic tools. And, for example, just by taking someone's blood, you can learn an awful lot about what's going on with a person by looking at various aspects of their blood. But when it comes to mental illness, there's no blood test. And even though now we have techniques where we can actually look at people's brains, you know, there's a lot going on there that you cannot see. Do you think that always means that this territory of mental illness is one that's going to be very hazy and it's going to be difficult to explore? We're going to have to do it by talking to people and getting them to describe their experiences, and it's going to have to be often a business as much of metaphor as it is with real physiological things and neurotransmitters and brain structures and things like that.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of metaphor per se, but I do think that the organ systems that we're dealing with are especially complex. So if you're thinking, for example, of the cardiovascular system, pulmonary system, and so forth, and then you talk about the central nervous system, the brain, we're dealing with an organ system that is vastly more complicated than the other ones that are addressed in medicine. And so it's going to be slower. But at the same time, I think that some of the breakthroughs in functional magnetic resonance imaging, for example, are going to provide a basis for sort of understanding what are some of the correlates in the brain that are associated with the phenomenon, say, of hallucinations, delusions, and schizophrenia. Several decades ago, we didn't have those sorts of technologies. And so people assumed that someone who is, say, hearing voices in the absence of anyone speaking must have something wrong with their brain. But what that might be, where in the brain these abnormalities might arise, totally unknown. But now with the functional neuroimaging, we can at least make advances in that direction to answering those sort of questions about what are some of the capacities in the brain that have gone awry to produce these kinds of symptoms. And by identifying where these problems are, this in turn might suggest pathways for intervention.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor McNally, for giving some of our time today. We appreciate it.
And thank you.
Our guest, Richard McNally, is professor of psychology at Harvard University. His book, What is Mental Illness?, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. We also want to say thanks to Evan Whitney, the technical director, on the other end of the connection here that we had with Harvard, because indeed Professor McNally was speaking to us from Harvard.